Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, violence has broken out in Kenya after the opposition candidate in Kenya's presidential election has claimed massive voter fraud. Raila Odinga, in his fourth presidential run, was yet again challenging Uhuru Kenyatta. Kenyatta is the incumbent. A local human rights commission has said it has found discrepancies between results announced by the government's election commission and paper forms signed at a polling station. Adding to the tension is that last week, a senior election official in charge of voting technology was found tortured and killed. The election results will have wide implications for the region. Here in studio to discuss all of this with us is Assumpta Oturu. And a follow-up to our coverage on Trump's Department of Justice challenging affirmative action yet again and using the tactic of pitting Asian versus Black students. Our guest is Kimberly West-Fulgham, professor at Loyola Law School. We continue our series on campaigners for Black Lives. We're joined by the founder of Black Lives Matter Toronto, Janae Khan, also known as Future. We focus on the growing international movement of Black Lives Matter. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. President Donald Trump followed up yesterday's aggressive rhetoric on North Korea with more via Twitter this morning. Trump tweeted that the U.S. nuclear arsenal is far stronger and more powerful than ever before. He also reaffirmed his threat from a day earlier by reposting video of it.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
Trump's early morning tweets came as Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was working to calm the North Korea crisis. Tillerson insisting there isn't any imminent threat. He spoke aboard his plane flying home from Asia with a stop planned in Guam.
I think Americans should sleep well at night. I have no concerns about this particular rhetoric of the last few days. I think the president, again, as commander in chief, I think he felt it necessary to issue a very strong statement directly to North Korea. But I think what the president was just reaffirming is the United States has the capability to fully defend itself.
Hours earlier, North Korea's army said in a statement read out on television that it was exploring plans for attacking the tiny U.S. territory of Guam, which houses U.S. military bases and is a common refueling stop for U.S. government aircraft crossing the Pacific.
The KPA Strategic Force is carefully examining the operational plan for making an enveloping fire at the areas around Guam with medium to long-range strategic ballistic rocket Hoisong 12.
The escalating rhetoric has heightened concern that a miscalculation could spiral out of control and lead to military conflict, possibly nuclear. The belligerent statements followed reports indicating North Korea can now mount miniaturized nuclear weapons on ballistic missiles, including those that might be able to hit the U.S. West Coast. Kenya's election took an ominous turn as violent protests erupted in the capital and elsewhere after opposition leader Raila Odinga alleged fraud. Odinga said hackers used the identity of a murdered official to infiltrate the database of the country's election commission and manipulate results. Soon after Odinga spoke on television, angry protesters in slums of Nairobi and an opposition stronghold in the southwest burned tires, set up roadblocks, and clashed with police. Kenyan police opened fire on protesters in yet another opposition stronghold, killing one person. Kenya's Election Commission said it will investigate Odinga's allegations. Incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta was leading Odinga with nearly all votes counted, 54 to 45%. South African President Jacob Zuma survived a secret ballot vote of no confidence in the parliament. If he'd lost, he and his cabinet would have been forced to resign. Zuma prevailed. 177 voted in favor of the no confidence motion. 198 were against it. 9 abstained. The ruling National African Congress holds 249 seats, which means dozens of its members split with Zuma. Still, the South African president was jubilant after the vote, greeting his supporters and avowing the ANC remains strong.
They believe they could use technicalities in parliament to take over the majority from the ANC. It's impossible. They can't do it. We represent the majority in the public.
Despite its failure in the no confidence motion, South Africa's main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, said it will propose that parliament be dissolved and early elections be called. Voters in Kansas City have approved a ballot measure to raise the city's minimum wage to $15 an hour by the year 2022. The measure won approval on a vote of better than 2-1, but the hike can't take effect. That's because Missouri legislators enacted a law earlier this year that bars cities from setting their own wage rates higher than the state level of $7.70 an hour. A coalition of Kansas City labor, economic justice, and religious groups placed the initiative on the ballot. A different group rallied as it launched a petition drive yesterday seeking to let Missouri voters decide next year whether to raise the state minimum wage to $12 an hour by the year 2023. Speakers said Missouri workers can't survive on the current wage scale.
I believe the majority of the people in the state of Missouri think minimum wage should be raised. Yeah, I think we should put it on the ballot and vote it.
Because as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, everyone who goes to work should be able to make a living wage. And we are not making a living wage. Thank you.
I'm Eileen Alfandera. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. A series of elections have happened on the continent of Africa recently, all of them controversial. A recent election in Zambia was challenged and resulted in an outbreak of violence. In Rwanda, Paul Kagame was elected, and I use that in quotes, to a controversial third term by allegedly winning 99% of the vote. And in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Joseph Kabila thus far has refused to hold elections despite mass protests calling for elections. And yesterday, Kenyans went to the poll for another matchup between two political dynasties, Uhuru Kenyatta, the incumbent, and 72-year-old Odinga. As of this morning, Odinga has challenged the election results, saying there was massive fraud. The results thus far show Kenyatta at 54.4% of the vote, with Odinga behind at 44.8%. This, despite polls showing a much tighter race. The Kenya Human Rights Commission has announced that they discovered some discrepancies between provisional results announced by Kenya's Election Commission and paper forms signed at least one polling station. There are new reports that violence has broken out in Odinga's strongholds, including the crucial port city of Mombasa. It is being reported that the government has shut down operations of train lines traveling from the port city and Odinga stronghold Mombasa to Nairobi, and reports of live rounds being fired at protesters. Some people are reporting it. We have no way of confirming it. Their fears of a repeat of Kenya's 2007 presidential election, where Odinga is said to have lost to the incumbent President Kibaki. Odinga alleged vote rigging after the Election Commission abruptly stopped tallying votes and announced that Kibaki was the winner. Protests and violence killed around 1,200 people and displaced 600,000. Out of that conflict, a power-sharing government formed, with Kibaki remaining president and Odinga becoming the prime minister. the outcome of the Kenya election could have widespread outcomes in the region, ranging from Kenya's participation in the African Union mission in Somalia, known as AMISOM, and is backed, by the way, by the U.S., that mission is, as well as the U.N. And the aim of the Africa Union mission in Somalia is to tackle al-Shabaab fighters. Al-Shabaab has made several attacks in Kenya, including the capital city of Nairobi. There have also been tensions between Kenya and Tanzania over trade. And Odinga is said to have a close personal relationship with Tanzania's president, but there are tensions between Tanzania's president and the current president of Kenya, Kenyatta. So here to discuss all of this with us, I'd like to welcome Assumpta Oturu. She is in studio with us. Assumpta, welcome.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you inviting me.
Yeah, well, we're happy to have you. We've been trying to get you on here for a while. Assumpta is the host and producer of Spotlight Africa, a weekly program on Pacifica Radio's KPFK. Spotlight Africa focuses on Africa's current affairs, politics, economic, social, and women's issues. And Assumpta hails from the continent. Assumpta, you have to tell us a little bit about yourself.
You know, I'm not good at that. So I'm always humbled when I'm asked to do that because I rarely do. So it's much better that I just say I host the show Spotlight Africa.
Well, she follows the continent very, very carefully, obviously, in preparation for the show, and is known because of the huge time difference between Southern California. Assumpta's show comes out of KPFK in Southern California. Assumpta often has to stay overnight doing interviews in the middle of the night. Assumpta, I don't know how you do it. But let us turn our attention to now what is happening in Kenya. What should people know about both of these candidates, about Kenyatta and Odinga?
As you rightly mentioned earlier, they both come from a dynasty because of their fathers. Kenyatta, of course, is the son of Kenya's founding president, Jomo Kenyatta. And Raila Odinga is the son of Jeremiah Odinga, who was the vice president of Kenya, the first vice president, but fell apart with Kenyatta. So that is really the strength of them both, that they come from this dynasty of people who have been in the struggle, because Jeremiah Odinga, or Raila Odinga's father, was also part of the struggle for independence. And not to make it ethnic, but the two main ethnic groups in Kenya are the Luos, where the former president of the U.S., Barack Obama's father, comes from, mm-hmm. and then you have the Kikuyu. Given what happened prior,
is one a minority?
The what?
The of the two tribes, the Kikuyu or the Luos.
I don't have the exact, but they are both in a strong group. So it's always how they are able to align themselves with others to be able to get the presidency. But so far, Kikuyus have been very successful in retaining the presidency. Yeah. Most of the Kenyan presidents, except for Daniel Arap Moi, all the others have been Kikuyu. Mm. So that sort of raises concern that you can't really have only one group, although there is always that claim that we fought for independence and therefore we have the legitimate right. But for how long do you sustain that? Because this is I always say it's a pie that should be evenly distributed so that everybody feels that they are participants in this pie. Yeah.
Yeah. So there have been tensions between these two families and these two ethnic groups going back for some time.
Yeah, there is a sort of not directly, but there is that invisible tension between the two groups. And, so that sort of creates that problem, because if one group has sustained the presidency for long, it's just like being here. In the United States, the Green Party wishes it could get into power, but it can't because of the fact that they're two dominant
political parties.
So it's always in the periphery of the politics of the country. So even if Raila Odinga is able to mobilize the population and show his strength, at the end of the day, those who control power would want to make sure that they stay on. So they do whatever they can.
Well, let me ask you this. I actually got an email from the All Africa Women's Group in London, and they sent on a list from Kenya women saying why they were not going to vote, you know, for the government. And then there've been a lot of talk about, well, young people and young people playing a major role, but also the women's vote playing a major role. But now here we are in a situation where the vote itself is being contested, and the fear of the repeat of what happened back in 2007. Kenyan police are said to fire tear gas at a group in Odinga's stronghold. They were unarmed supporters of Odinga that were chanting, "No rally and no peace." And Reuters is also saying the opposition has faced problems at the polls, names missing from the registrar, electronic voter ID devices failing, and even agents being denied entry into polling stations. And honestly, it reminded me of being, you know, in Port-au-Prince during the Haitian election. But of course, this is huge, given the role, the critical role that Kenya plays, you know, within the region. So your thoughts on how, in terms of what the candidates represented, we know that Odinga has come out and said, well, we want to pull out troops, Kenya troops from Somalia. He also has a close working relationship, we're told, with the president of Tanzania. And there have been tensions on trade between Kenya and Tanzania, including Tanzania refusing access to a huge dairy company apparently owned by Kenyatta. So you have to, keep that in mind. But what should we know about what each of those candidates really represent?
Wow, that's a very interesting question, and quite loaded as well, because I can only say that in terms of what has happened right now, there is a cloud hanging in reference to the murder of Chris Musando, who was the manager of the data center infrastructure.
Yeah.
He was, as you had mentioned earlier, and of course, Raila references to the fact that the hackers used his identity to sort of make changes, which could be, which we don't know, but there is suspicion as to what happened and who was behind his murder and why was he killed. Those are all questions that need to be asked. And as somebody with IT background, you also wonder how come they did not sort of block his, his access to once he was dead, because the torture seems to symbolize that something was taken from him and so forth. So,
and his identity was used, it is claimed, as part of the hacking.
Yeah, so, but we don't know, maybe there is other additional information that they had, that even if you block their user ID, they would still be able to access the information, so that there is that cloud. And then also recently, I think it was on Saturday or Sunday, the police, opposition also made reference that their tallying center was vandalized, and the suspicion was that the police were party to that. And then also you have other members of foreign nationals who were deported from Kenya, and they were working in sort of helping the opposition as well. So there is a lot of suspicion already for the people that happened before Tuesday, and there were a lot of things that had been said clouding what was going to the results. And then suddenly we begin to see results trickling in and showing Kenyatta on lead, and everybody saying,
and
wow,
a huge lead.
Yeah, it was 10%, a very huge, and then you begin to wonder what is going on. So I think right now maybe the Independent Electoral Boundaries Commission is rethinking, reevaluating, but Chris Musando was the key in terms of ensuring that the vote was secure. But he's dead, he was tortured
and killed. And I heard this morning that apparently the Election Commission said that they're going to try to come up with a way of, you know, of verifying the results. And this was from the South African Broadcasting Company, from a report they did. And the implication is why don't they have one right now? But just for people in this country listening, you know, because you're used to knowing, well, you know somewhat of the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, although there are some people who say there is no difference. I think there is a difference between looking at Donald Trump. You mentioned the Green Party not being able to get a look in the UK and their politics. You can see a difference between the Labour Party, headed by Jeremy Corbyn, and the right-wing conservative Tories. Do you have that clear a distinction between Kenyatta and Odinga, or is it much more fluid, if you know what I mean?
I think in our part of the world, it's always, I think I'll quote the words of Meles Zewani, who said one time during a debate on this issue that for us, the question is not issues, because we don't control the presidency. Someone else controls the presidency.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So even if you discuss issues and so forth, whether once you get into office you'll be able to do that, that is a big question. So saying that, people still debate issues, and the country is much concerned about unemployment. The country is concerned about food supply. The country is concerned about access to education, access to health care, and so forth. And during and these are issues that Raila Odinga raised. And Kenyatta, of course, response was, or we are going to give you free health, free education, and so forth. So even if you go to the maternity and you're giving birth, you have free health. But then the question is, will he really fulfill that, having failed in the last 4 years to do the very things that he's talking about? And then on top of that, the question is, why is there so much corruption? And people are concerned about that. And Kenyatta has not been able to sort of slam the corruption. And when it comes to the relationship between Raila Odinga and the new president of Tanzania, the president of Tanzania seems to be making some headway, mm-hmm. Because he's fighting against corruption. He's doing whatever it is to sort of clamp down on people who are corrupt and so on. And most times people tend to think of Raila as being the person who is more sympathetic towards the left, and uh-huh. there is always that fear that once you are quote unquote referenced to that, because he had some training in I think it was East Germany and so forth, mm-hmm. so that always hangs. Mm. Yeah, people tend to refer to him. Yeah, he has those left tendencies, but in a country where everybody's poor and people are hungry, it doesn't really matter what politics is it at, as long as you are able to provide for the people.
Yeah, and that's really good. You said it was a complicated question, but your answer hit the nail right on the head. And it does seem, I mean, every time we cover a lot about the Global South here on Sojourner Truth in terms of Latin America, looking at what's happening in Venezuela, Haiti, you know, and other places, Honduras, et cetera. But on the continent in particular, you know, when you think of what's happening in the Congo and just the genocide really that's happening there in other parts, you really see proxies you know what I mean, of like who's really in charge here. So you have these global powers with global interests that are, you know, pulling the strings. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't have collaborators, corrupt collaborators on the ground, which they do. We saw that going back to the days of Patrice Lumumba, you know, the days of when, you know, we were also hopeful about African unity, you know, and more. So, you know, I think you're right to really that we have to look at all of this within that context. But also, you know, there's also the nagging view, I mean, of when you look at the Western media, and politicians, when they speak about Africa, it's always, well, what do you expect? These people really can't manage their own affairs. But meanwhile, they're behind the scenes controlling the wealth, pulling the strings, and cutting the deal. So I just wanted you to comment on that. And, the time, we need like more time with you or something. The time is going by too quickly. Because when we look at, I mentioned earlier, the other elections that's going on. I mean, in Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo, Kabila refusing, it seems, to even hold an election. And then in Rwanda, Kagame saying, well, he won by 99% of the vote. In Zambia, all kinds of confusion. Are there any others that we should mention here in terms of elections happening on the continent?
Of course, Liberia is also having elections. And, Angola, too, is having elections. But we know what the results will be in Angola because President Dos Santos, Eduardo Dos Santos, handpicked his successor. So we know which direction that is. And in Rwanda, it's very interesting because we are always told not to be ethnic, but ethnic issues rise up in Rwanda because we talk about the genocide and so forth. So if the Tutsis are in the minority, so the Hutu must have given Kagame a good vote for him to get 99%.
one would think so.
So that he could get that. But then quickly, in terms of validation of the vote in Kenya, I listened to the interviews that Chris Msando gave before he was assassinated or was murdered.
This is the election official
Murdered. Yeah, the head of the data center and infrastructure center in the Independent Electoral Boundaries Commission, was that before the election, before the results are sent out, they had to tally them at the constituency level, and then they have to copy that onto a form that lists all the candidates and who has won what.
Yeah.
And then all the officials have to sign off, including the returning officer. Then they will transfer that information onto the electoral system. And once they do that, it automatically tells them to scan. It asks you to scan that paper as well. So that should serve as a backup to show that these were the results that came out. So one does not understand why the IEBC is saying we are now looking at how to verify this, because they have those verification. And he also mentioned that...
The Electoral Commission.
The Electoral Commission, that if... at the constituency level, you have 2,000 registered voters. I'm just using a number out of my head. If 2,000 were registered and you only showed 1,000, then you are not able to transmit the information because you have to explain the difference because the system won't let you. Unless they were able to hack and devoid that and so on. So we wouldn't know at what level the hacking took place.
That's right. And finally, because we're actually a little bit over time, people often wonder, well, why is all this stuff happening? And, you know, and behind that question, there's also always, to me, a piece of racism. Why is there all these wars and tribal conflicts and elections that, don't go as planned, not to mention what's happening in the United States. And, you know, it's the answer, or what I always try to underscore, is that so much of the wealth of the world is under the ground in Africa. I mean, the practically everything that's needed for cell phones, for airplanes, for televisions, for weapons, you name it, including precious jewels, the diamonds, the gold, etc., is under that continent. So when you have to look, when you look at why proxy wars happen or why world powers are so interested in maintaining a level of dysfunction and confusion and slaughter on the continent, one has to keep that in mind. What are your thoughts on this? And then using corruption. Yeah. The CIA has made clear that they use corruption as part of what they do and what they're after.
Yeah, you sort of answered the question, but that interest is very strong. And even in Kenya, going a little bit in history, because the British, this was a former British colony,
yeah,
and the British interests have always been the factor. In the 60s, there was the revolt of the military throughout East Africa, meaning the three founding countries, that is Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania. The British forces came in, and Ugandans and Tanzania say refused for them to stay. And ever since then, they have been in Kenya, yeah, and they are still there. So sometimes people make the joke that it really depends if the British are going to let go of the Kenyatta family, of the Kikuyu dominance in Kenyan politics. Then,
well,
maybe,
yeah,
we'll see change. And many were hoping that this would be it, that at least Raila would be the one to bring about that change. So we'll wait and see what's going to happen in the next couple of days. But
absolutely,
I hope that peace will prevail, that they will have to. But you are right when you talks about, when you reference resources, that's the main factor, that you keep people distracted, preoccupied with something else. Why you take the resources,
steal,
and so
right.
forth. And if the continent is so bad, why is it that when you board the plane in any European city, the majority of the people in the plane are mostly European and so on, they are Caucasian, there are very few Africans. You can actually count how many Africans are in a flight. So if Africa...
From flights in Africa, right.
No, flying into Africa.
Flying into Africa, right.
Yeah, you go to Johannesburg and you look at when you are lining up for entry, the majority of the people around you are white. So if it's so bad, why are they there?
Why are they flocking? Well, we're out of time and so much more to cover. So Assumpta, we've been trying to get you in here for a while. Now you see it's not so terrible, right? So are you going to come back? Can we have you back again so we could continue this important discussion about
the continent?
Of course,
I will.
Assumpta, the host of Spotlight Africa weekly program on Pacifica Radio's KPFK. Assumpta, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, too.
All right. Okay, we're going to take our station break now, and our next guest has been patiently waiting to discuss the latest attack on affirmative action by the Trump administration. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
La, 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 la. People die, people cry in my Africa. People die, people cry in my continent. I'm afraid of politicians. I'm afraid for my Africa. Nazali Kubanga Bosoki Atamoto.
And that song is Jaipur by Dobe Gahore. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Check us out on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott on SoundCloud. And today we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners, not only in Kenya, but throughout the continent of Africa. And if you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. Just look for Sojourner Truth and check out our website, www.sotrueradio.org, where you could also get all of our back shows. We are now going to move on to the controversy over affirmative action. Last Tuesday, news broke that the Justice Department will now use its civil rights division to target so-called reverse racism in college admissions, reverse discrimination, investigating and potentially suing universities that use race as one of a number of factors in deciding which students to admit, which some claim discriminates against white and Asian applicants. The Justice Department is already gearing up for its first investigation into an affirmative action complaint from a large group of Asian American students against Harvard University. Now, I looked at the incoming class at Harvard, and then one does the breakdown by, in terms of Black students, Latino students, Native American students, and Asian American students. Asian American students were 22%. They had the highest percentage of quote-unquote ethnic minorities coming into Harvard University. But our guest, Kimberly West Falcon, has written, "A lot of what people think they know about affirmative action in college admissions is inaccurate." So we want to welcome her and see what she has to say. Kimberly West Falcon, professor at Loyola Law School, where she holds the endowed James P. Bradley Chair in Constitutional Law. She holds her law degree from Yale Law School and has worked as a civil rights attorney, a litigator, including suing UC Berkeley for discrimination in admissions on behalf of Black, Latino, and Filipino students after the school removed affirmative action. Her academic articles have appeared in many highly regarded law journals, and her latest article, Obscuring Asian Penalty with Illusions of Black Bonus, was recently published by the UCLA Law Review. Kimberly, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So when you say that, based on your analysis, you're saying data shows that a university's discrimination against Asian applicants is directly linked to a bias towards admitting white students, not affirmative action for Black and Latino students. Let's unpack that for us.
Yes, one of the things that, as you said in your gracious introduction, I've had the opportunity to represent students of color in lawsuits challenging admissions policies in the past, and what that's given me the opportunity to do is to really hone in on what the analysis should be if you're trying to vindicate the civil rights of a group like Asian Americans. And what you would look at and what historically civil rights lawyers look at is, well, what's the group and who's the group that is getting in at the highest rate? Who's applying in the not just the largest numbers, but whose selection rate is the highest? And despite the headline and despite the tactics of attacking affirmative action, if the issue is really getting underneath whether Asian Americans are suffering discrimination, it requires looking at whether whites are getting in at higher rates when they're similarly situated to Asian Americans, and whether it is the lawsuit that went to the Supreme Court twice where a rejected white applicant named Abigail Fisher alleged, quote-unquote, reverse discrimination, or the Harvard admissions policy, what you often find is that the numbers of African Americans and Latinos at issue is really very small and too small to be the reason that Asian Americans are suffering from discrimination. And so in the case that I mentioned that went to the Supreme Court twice, you actually find that the white and Asian American admission rate is twice the Black and Latino admission rate. So that would be an example of the kind of numerical or statistical finding that just doesn't align with the headlines or the notion that we should be using the resources of the Justice Department to go after quote-unquote reverse discrimination. The statistics often show that the numerical disparities are still showing exclusion and disproportionate exclusion of African Americans and Latinos.
Yeah. And so when you say, and people refer to the quote unquote Asian penalty in admissions, is there an Asian penalty? And if there is, how does it play out?
Well, that is a really important question. And actually, the numbers and the mathematical analysis align with a lot of what our common sense notions about race discrimination already are, that if you are seeking to vindicate civil rights for any racial group, you don't usually generalize. You don't say that all universities are engaged in discrimination, or at least not legally cognizable discrimination against African Americans and Latinos. You look at a particular university, you look at their particular policy, you look at their particular selection rates, and then dig into the question of, well, what is this university doing? So when it comes to this question of an Asian penalty, what I'm trying to get at and what my analysis is getting at in my article is that there's a methodology, a tried and true and a legally known methodology for answering that question. And it has been true that there have been universities, often universities on the West Coast, where there are substantial numbers of Asian American applicants applying and being admitted to universities, where those universities have been found to be discriminating against Asian Americans, possibly imposing either an implicit or explicit ceiling that they don't want the university to tip too Asian American, that it might lose its elite character, and you can read into that its white character. So it really can be an issue, but it's not something that can be generalized, and it's not something that is the same as discrimination against whites. It's very rare, and I've yet to find statistics that support a finding of discrimination against whites in the traditional definition of whites are being excluded. So what I have seen with respect to the Texas case, the case that went to the Supreme Court twice, I did not find, when I did that analysis, a disparity in Asian American admission rates. What I found there was that Asian Americans and whites were admitted at a 22% rate, and that rate was double the admission rate for African Americans and Latinos. So another one of those facts, as I said earlier, that's surprising, is that the case that many Americans heard about, where the rejected white applicant was alleging race discrimination, whites in her group were admitted at, again, 22%, whereas African Americans were admitted at 8% and Latinos at 10%. So this is an area where you have individuals defining race discrimination drastically differently than the common sense idea of race discrimination. It's the idea that if you have an affirmative action policy, that equates to race discrimination. And the question of Asian penalty is more complicated. And so whether Harvard is engaged in that kind of discrimination against Asian Americans has yet to be revealed. Those statistics aren't out there. What statistics are there are the ones that you addressed and recounted in my introduction. And I will just add one more, is that the entering class of Harvard this year is likely maybe close to 49% white, 22% Asian, 14% African American, and less Latino and Native American. So at that level, we certainly don't have any evidence that affirmative action is penalizing Asian Americans.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we are out of time for that. We covered this story last week. We're going to continue to cover this, but we want to thank you for joining us and thank you for your work. And people could find your article in the UCLA Law Review. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay. Thank you, Kimberly West Falcon. Thank you for joining
thank
us.
You.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now on Monday, Black Lives Matter Pennsylvania helped shut down a press conference at the Philadelphia City Hall as part of a protest against the killing of David Jones, a young black man who was shot in the back by Philadelphia police officer Ryan Powell on June 8th. Police are claiming that they stopped Jones for allegedly driving a dirt bike recklessly on the street. And they say that he removed a handgun from his waistband, but a witness said Jones never waved a weapon and was actually running away from police. He was shot in the back, mind you. He was 30 years old. And a representative, Asa Khalif of Black Lives Matter Pennsylvania, said, quote, since day one, we have been demanding justice and transparency in the David Jones case. They have not given it to us, which is why we have continued to protest in the streets as well as in press conferences. The protest on Monday was about holding politicians accountable. Pennsylvania State Attorney General is now investigating the case. Well, frankly, I'm not holding out a lot of hope on that. This is the very same Pennsylvania where 2 years ago, 26 police officers were caught on video beating down a young black man, 22-year-old Tyree Carroll, for what? For riding his bike the wrong way on the block where his grandmother lived. These 26 police officers have not been disciplined. They're still on the job. And meanwhile, Tyree himself was arrested and then rearrested on a trumped-up retaliatory charge. So we're now continuing our series on campaigners for Black Lives. And I'd like to welcome Janaya Khan, who is the co-founder of Black Lives Matter Canada. She has become a leading voice in the global crusade demanding social transformation, justice, equality, known as Future within the Black Lives Matter movement. She is Black, queer, gender nonconforming activist, a staunch Afrofuturist, a boxer and social justice educator. There's a lot more I could say about Future. Future, welcome back to Sojourner Truth. It's been way too long, I think a couple of years.
Yeah, it's good to be back, Margaret.
Yeah. So, Janaya, you heard what I said about Philadelphia, and I'm particularly interested to talk with you, having founded a Black Lives Matter in Toronto, because increasingly we're hearing about the global reach and global support for Black Lives Matter. Tell us first about Toronto, but then about the global work of Black Lives Matter and why you think this is critical.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're someone who grew up in Canada and you are a black person, anytime that you try to start a conversation on race, the first thing that people say is, but it's not as bad as the States, right? And so you grow up with this myth that Canada was the place where everyone went to get free, and there's references to the Underground Railroad. And the reality is, if you were a black person in Toronto a few years ago, you were more likely to be carded, which is the New York version of stop and frisk, than you were if you were, you know, to be stopped as a black person in the streets of New York City. So there was all these historical myths and these contemporary myths that weren't making sense for our lived experience. And so we understood that we needed to interrupt those ideas and really name anti-black racism in the country. And we were seeing some of the things that were happening in the United States around Black Lives Matter and had to ask ourselves if developing a chapter and a national discourse was something that we should and could do under the name Black Lives Matter, and we found that we could. And since then, I think Black Lives Matter Toronto has turned into one of the most instrumental chapters, and certainly has created a national discourse where you're seeing chapters popping up across Canada, despite mm-hmm. The reality that black people only make up 2.9% of the population of Canada. So it's been huge. We've had pretty significant wins. And again, we're fighting some of the same types of discrimination when it comes to police brutality, when it comes to incarceration, when it comes to housing injustice, albeit on what feels like a smaller scale because of our population differences. And we've been able to secure some wins as a result of that.
Right. And so tell us, too, about, because I saw you in London, England. You spoke at a conference that I was participating in, but you were also there meeting with some folks. What about this growth of the movement for Black Lives, if not Black Lives Matter organization, but certainly the movement for Black Lives Matter in so many countries around the world? What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the need to make those global connections is absolutely necessary. Anywhere where black people are in the world, anti-black racism exists. And if we're not sharing tools and strategies and stories, we're not growing and developing as a movement. And so, you know, in London at the time, I was there to suss out the possibility of developing a Black Lives Matter sort of awareness out there and what could come out of that. And since then, there has been a BLM UK, and we also connected with Sisters Uncut and the NUS student body. And we've made those connections, and we continue to have those connections. Even more recently, we just went out to Colombia, meeting with the organizers of the strike that happened in Buenaventura, where you have a massively, massively neglected group of people who work the ports that bring in millions and millions of dollars that subsidize the entire country, but have a 66% rate of unemployment. So we're talking about one of the only black cities in the country, and they have a 66% unemployment rate.
Yeah,
where there is often no running water or clean water, and where their homes are in constant jeopardy. And so those are very urgent circumstances and urgent conditions. And when you think about no access to running water, you have to think about Flint, Michigan, where you're not getting access to clean water, where lead poisoning is something that is very, very obvious, something that's been proven. People have been poisoned because of it. Children have been poisoned because of it. And still, there has not been the kind of justice that would have happened should that have been a white city. And we know this. Making those kinds of connections, you are going to share tactics. You are going to show that what's happening isn't just specific to the states. And here's the thing. We understand that if black people are fighting for freedom in the United States, black people are fighting for freedom everywhere. And if black people were to somehow get free in the United States, whatever that means, because it means so many different things, but at this moment, it means having access to basic human rights and freedom of fear, that if black people get free in America, that doesn't mean they're necessarily going to get free everywhere else in the world. And so we actually have to be connecting with each other's struggles. We have to be aware of each other's struggles. We have to be aware of what's happening, in Palestine. We have to be aware of what's happening in Brazil. And we have to be supporting those movements. I can't tell you how important it was for those folks in Colombia to hear that people in the U.S. understood what was happening for them, that people in the U.S. understood that what their national media was putting out in Colombia was very different than their own experiences, that they're being vilified for fighting. And something that I think is so important to name, and it's what you brought up, Margaret, with Pennsylvania, and continue to say, is protest isn't the first choice for us. Oftentimes, protest is one of the last resorts when other means of intervention have not been respected, when we tried other means of intervention and they've been sort of cast aside or they have not worked. And protests where people are literally putting their bodies on the line is often the last resort. And so we have to be sharing tactics and strategies on what that looks like, and also how best to support each other and uplift and amplify the stories of resistance that are happening as they are. So I think that globalized resistance, I think that is really where we need to be focusing our work on, not just creating a national discourse, but an international policy and understanding of what anti-black racism looks like everywhere in the world and what it's going to take to actually fight it.
Yeah, absolutely. And last week on our show, Patrice Cullors, one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter in the U.S., was on, and we talked a little bit about the kind of Pan-African view. And my worry that what had happened is with bringing in the term African-American or Afro-American, there was much more of a focus of being American and really not concerning ourselves with the rest of us from the diaspora. I'm from Barbados, very involved with supporting the grassroots in Haiti, for example. So I was very glad to hear Patrice, and now to hear you talk about the importance of this kind of globalized resistance, and not only focusing on what is happening in our own cities, in our own communities, and also building strategies and tactics that will empower people out in the diaspora as well. So just a quick final thought, Future.
Yeah. When I first came out to the U.S., I think there was a couple of years ago, there was a bit of resistance around the idea of sort of pushing back against a national narrative of freedom, mm-hmm. And moving more into a sort of Pan-African one.
Yeah.
But that pushback isn't necessary anymore, because I think people are really starting to recognize the need for it. And, especially living in a Trump America, because you can't live in a place like the U.S., especially with the Trump administration, and not consider foreign policy and the implications of U.S. Capitalism everywhere else in the world.
Right.
And it means that we actually have to be responsible in a particular way. And that means engagement in ways that I think are uncomfortable. And so what I'm looking forward to in the future is really us critically debating and engaging on issues like foreign policy and the role of electoral politics locally, right, and eventually on a federal level when it comes to its implications of sort of U.S. capitalism and globalization in other countries, and how we can better support those movements by actually impeding and inhibiting, you know, really disastrous foreign policy and the support of militarized arms against people who are freedom fighters in other countries. I think that's our next big step.
Okay.
And, that's where I really want to see change.
Wonderful. On that note, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there. I hope to have you back. Thank you so much, Future. We're out of time. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team, our intern Sherelle Withers. I'd like to thank Melina Abdullah. We partnered with her on our Black Lives Matter series. Assistant producer Stephanie Case, our engineer Kiana Williams. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.